Welcome to A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and Pam Van Dyke, Regal's darling managing editor. Today, we are looking forward to discussing the craft of memoir with two of our Regal House authors, Jane Bernstein and Julie Witschlag. We look forward to discussing the inspiration behind their respective literary works, the definition and intent of the memoir narrative, the challenges entailed in such a task, and the role of truth in the formulation of content. But before we get into all that thrilling back and forth, Pam, can you tell us a little bit more about our lovely guests today?
I'd be delighted. Today we have Julie Witschlag and Jane Bernstein. Julie's cultural memoir and essays, This All at Onceness, was named one of Kirkus Review's best indie books of 2019. Julie has an MFA from Lesley University, and her work has appeared in numerous publications, including Ninth Letter, The Tampa Review, The Writer's Chronicle, and Panegyrus, as well as the new Bloomsbury publishing collection, The Science of Story, The Brain Behind Creative Nonfiction. Julie lives in the Boston area, where she is a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti, an online journal of ideas and opinions. She also received a Kirkus starred review, and here's what they had to say about her work. Schlack's graceful prose balances clear-eyed reflection with luminous passages that celebrate past passions, a thoughtful, witty, and evocative recollection of a life and the convictions that energized it. Jane Bernstein is the author of six books, including the memoirs Loving Rachel, Bereft, A Sister's Story, and Rachel in the World. Her essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Creative Nonfiction, Fourth Genre, and The Sun, along with other journals, and her awards include two National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships in Creative Writing. She is a lapsed screenwriter and a professor of English at Carnegie Mellon University. You can read some of her shorter works on her website at www.janebernstein.net. Her novel, The Face Tells a Secret, is published by us, Regal House Publishing. Publishers Weekly has this to say about Bereft. This memoir is an eloquent and unflinchingly candid investigation, not so much of a crime, but rather of the subtleties and complexities of human relationships and the ways that a parent's discomfort with emotional outpourings can lead a child to suppress feelings that need an outlet. So, welcome, Jane and Julie. We're very excited about this today. We're going to delve in. David Mamet once wrote, "I love all insider memoirs. It doesn't matter whether it's truck drivers or doctors. I think everybody likes to go backstage." So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to go backstage to talk with both of you about your wonderful work and find out what you have to say about it. So I'll start with you, Julie. Can you start us off by telling us a brief summary of This All at Onceness and maybe share a bit of your inspiration behind it?
Sure. I think I can. I have to say, I never quite nailed the elevator pitch for this book because it covers a lot of territory. The inspiration is actually odd. I heard a little bit on NPR about a broadcast that happened in 1967 when communication satellites were brand new. It was this broadcast called Our World, and it was this very idealistic two-hour thing that involved broadcasting to and from every continent in the world, every time zone in the world, in real time. And the goal behind it was really to help people realize that, you know, we're all inhabiting the same small planet. We really are a global village. We're really interdependent. It was a very lofty and sort of idealistic vision behind this thing. And I always thought, I sort of put it on the shelf thinking at some point I would want to write about that. Then I got into an MFA program and was doing a lot of personal essays and memoir about, you know, growing up in the 60s, as well as about what was in my present life, doing online market research and participating in online communities and social media and social listening. And I finally realized in the course of writing about those things that there was a strong connection between sort of my own vision in 1967 when I, you know, turned 13 and sort of came of age as an official teenager in the same summer that this Our World broadcast happened. And when I looked at the trajectory of my own life in terms of idealism and cynicism and despair. And I looked at the trajectory of this original vision of sort of technology as a means of connecting the world to what we've got going on today on Twitter and in social media. I realized that there was a lot of interconnectedness and braiding to be done. So the book, in Not So Brief, is a collection of essays, some of which are you know, personal memoirish accounts of key junctures in my own life, past and present, and some of which are a bit more expansive and political in their orientation. But hopefully, at the end, they all work together.
Fantastic. Well, I know that this All at Once-ness covers a lot of ground, and we're going to talk a little later about how you chose the events that ended up in the collection. So thank you for that, and we'll get right back to you. So Jane, you have several memoirs. Can you give us a summary of your work and your inspiration behind it?
Sure. And I'll connect it with the Regal House novel, Face Tells the Secret. So I started my writing life as a writer of fiction, and really it was the only thing, the only genre that really interested me. And then in 1983, my second daughter was born with a very uncommon disorder. And at birth, she was blind and had intellectual disabilities and had a really shaky potential future. And that was 1983. Memoir wasn't really a big thing. It was the last thing in the world that I wanted was to write about her. Again, I saw myself as a fiction writer. That was like how I knew how to process things, that even though my fiction wasn't autobiographical, I was still kind of accessing things in the world that way. But then, there's not time in this podcast to go through the whole thing, I did end up writing what became a memoir, although, again, 1983, they didn't even call it a memoir when it was published. It was just a work of nonfiction. And I ended up writing it as if it were a novel, although I then actually gave it to my then husband and physicians who had been working with my daughter to have them fact check it. It was like I had to fool myself into writing from truth, because at that point, I really didn't know how to do it. And then that book, which was basically in a sentence, like what happens to a family when a less than perfect child is born. And that kind of opened me up to the second memoir, which was really about the repercussions of my sister's murder in 1966 in Arizona. And that was structurally a very different book. I had actually attempted to work with that material as fiction, and I never could really grasp it. So I wrote that as a memoir. And then the third book, structurally, is actually like Julie's book in the sense that it's like linked essays. It's called Rachel in the World. And it's really the same Rachel, my second-born daughter, starting at the age of 8 and taking her to the time in which she was no longer living with me, but living in a community living arrangement. So in the interim, I have to say, I really became an advocate. I mean, writing memoir really was opened something up for me. And Face Tells the Secret was a way of going back to writing from imagination. And then once the material is out, starting to see the ways, the kind of threads of things in my own life that had shaped that story.
Wonderful. I would like to talk about the distinction between a biography and an autobiography and a memoir, if you don't mind. A biography or an autobiography tells the story of a life. Well, a memoir often tells a story from a life, including touchstone events and turning points from the author's life. And the terms memoir and autobiography are commonly used interchangeably, and the distinction between these two genres is often blurred. The Bedford Glossary of Critical and Literary Terms say that memoirs differ from autobiographies in their, quote, degree of outward focus. Well, memoirs can be considered a form of autobiographical writing. The personalized accounts tend to focus more on what the writer has witnessed than on his or her own life, character, and developing self. What do you think of this notion that memoirs tend to be outwardly focused and descriptive of witnessed events rather than the writer's own developing self? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Julie, would you like to start us off?
Sure, that's a very interesting and provocative definition, and I don't think I agree with it. I think of autobiography as a largely factual, generally chronological account of what's happened. I think memoir is much more about making meaning of something, so it tends to be more thematic. Patricia Hampel had a great definition. She said, memoir is the intersection of narration and reflection, of storytelling and essay writing. And then she goes on to say, it can present its story and consider the meaning of the story. And to me, that's what makes memoir so dynamic, is that constant oscillation between past and present and what you experienced, you know, in the moment and the sense you make of it now. So I think memoir is very much a dialogue with oneself.
I really agree with Julie's definition. I would just expand it a little bit to say that in some cases of like pure memoir, like for instance, in my Rachel books, what I realized was that my mission was to use my own experience as a way to think about issues that were certainly larger than my own lived experience. So it became an interesting way of storytelling. I think when I think of Julie's definition, I think of it at its intersection with essays, which is a form is so vibrant and I really, really love. I love reading essays. You know, so we'll say essay slash memoir in that sense, where it's true that the process of writing memoir is really interwoven. It's true with kind of mulling over issues and circling around issues and trying to figure things out and not necessarily coming up with solutions, but more like accommodations or vantage points.
Actually, just to build on that for 1 second, Jane, there's a great book about memoir writing called The Art of Memoir by Mary Carr, which I often use in teaching. And she talks about how, were she to write The Liars Club, which was her first big memoir today, as opposed to when she actually wrote it, it would be a very different book because her understanding of herself and her family has evolved since she first wrote it. And I think that sort of gets to the heart of, again, of the difference that in autobiography, the facts are the facts and they're while your memory may change somewhat, an autobiography is not going to be as subject to change and constant reinterpretation as memoir is, because memoir is about the narrative you have constructed about your own life, and that changes.
Yes. Excellent, excellent. And this definition does also presuppose that you can separate witnessed events from the author's developing self, and I don't know that that really is true. Jane, what do you think?
Yeah, it's so interesting to me that I could rewrite everything. There would be totally different books. It's really true. And I think for some writers, they actually do that. I mean, they take the same story and they reprocess it. And if they're really good writers, it's totally interesting having another vantage point on it, looking at the same life and the same experiences from a different age. It's pretty fascinating.
And it's so interesting listening to you both talk about this, because it reminds me of a discussion we had about poetry in our last podcast with Zach and Martha. And we talked about poetry as almost being an organic animal. And it sounds like memoirs might be something of the same, where there is an evolutionary process and it is ever changing, which is rather intriguing. And perhaps autobiographies that are written from a later vantage point, you know, are more static in their recitation of events and facts that comprise a life.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I like your use of recitation. God help us if that's all we're doing.
But sometimes sometimes you read memoirs that are written very close to the events, and there's something about the rawness of lived experience that makes them really powerful. I'm thinking of like Cheryl Strayed's earliest work before her big book. Those essays were so raw. And then sometimes I think when you're older and a little bit more removed, then you get that sort of memoirs like processing and looking at different vantage points. And you know, they tend to have more of that essay quality, I think, sometimes.
Do either of you feel that it's better to have some distance from an event in your life or an event in society or in your community versus writing about it immediately?
It's very interesting. I mean, certainly I find with students a lot of times in trying to process difficult material, difficult people, they certainly need more time to process because I think the instinct, particularly when somebody has been hurt and you're young, is to really like just simply see that person as a villain. And sometimes age gives you, and that vantage point gives you the opportunity of actually seeing that person from different angles. I mean, scene writing is really great for that because you can actually see a person in action and you then sometimes have a slightly more nuanced view. But I think sometimes raw pieces have their effect too. The rawness of something just having happened, that can be really powerful.
Yeah, I agree with what you've said, Jane. It seems to me that the memoir I like best typically shows the writer actually arguing with herself on the page. We sort of get to see that the writer's almost colluding with the reader about, am I remembering this right? Am I just projecting this? Did I think this then versus now? So I think a lot of the ingredients that make memoirs so dynamic and interesting are kind of inherent in the passage of time. But I don't think it's essential. I mean, I think, yes, you can certainly write effectively about things as they're happening as well. But it may be a flatter experience.
I read one of Cheryl Strayed's essays in The Sun. It's been a couple of years now. But I remember reading it thinking, wow, she was brave to write that. It was some very raw material about her relationship with her. I believe it was with her ex-husband. But it was beautifully written. It was a raw piece, but it was also very empathetic. And I wonder if a writer, a young writer or someone writing directly after an event can write with empathy versus pointing the finger, if that is what makes a raw piece more successful.
I think that's a piece of it. I think also being able to get very, very close to the burning center of emotion and yet at the same time, I hate to use these words, but at the same time, not being self-indulgent, but being close. That's what she does. And if I think, Pam, we're talking about the same piece. I think it's called Heroin with a slash E at the end. And it's chilling because of how much revelation there is, but there's nothing self-indulgent about it at the same time. You feel that she is a writer in charge of her craft and yet still close enough to the emotions that she can render them for strangers, for people who've never met her.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned earlier, Jane, that when you wrote your first memoir, that it wasn't even called a memoir then. It was called Creative Nonfiction. I find this really interesting because I feel there's been an upsurge in what we call memoir. Recently, just in the last year, I read Sally Mann's Hold Still, where she's talking about her family life, but also her work as a photographer. And shortly after that, I read Anne Truitt's Daybook. And she writes a lot about motherhood and work and being a single mom. And I thought it was really interesting for me because those books were in conversation with each other. But I had the feeling that when Anne Truitt's Daybook was published, it was published simply as her journals versus calling it a memoir. But having said that, both of those were written as a way to pass down a personal legacy rather than necessarily being a historical document. And I just wonder what your thoughts are regarding the upsurge in memoirs or how what we call memoir or how we change things to suit, you know, to suit the market, maybe. I'm not really sure. How do both of you feel about that?
I suspect you know more about the sort of history of the genre, so I'll say one thing and then pass off to you. And that is just, I don't think good memoir has to be about trauma, but much of it is. So I don't know if that is just the industry's bias toward sensationalism, but some of the best memoirs I've read, you know, are not necessarily about trauma or dysfunctional families, but they're just simply closely observed relationships and experiences that the writer is making some broader sense of. So, you know, I don't even remember the author's name, but there was a memoir called something like My Name is Zippy. And it was just about a happy kid growing up. And it was delightful and not at all trite and very relatable. Or if you read a lot of David Sedaris's essays, right, there's nothing terribly dramatic going on there, except, you know, the incredible richness of sibling and family relationships.
Yeah, so many things to say. but first, I totally agree. I mean, memoir does not have to be about trauma, but I think one of the reasons for this sudden surge of the population, of the popularity of memoir, is that memoirs were writing stories and revealing ways in which people were living that hadn't really been written about before. And I think there was some prurient interest, and I think there are bad memoirs about trauma, but I also think a lot of doors were open. In my period of time, not so much with the first Rachel book, which I'll get to in a second, but with the Bereft, the book about my sister's murder, that was a period of time where there was a lot of male anger about women who were airing their dirty laundry. Remember that expression? So I think there was this way in which memoirs, particularly memoirs by women, they were really coinciding with women beginning to tell stories that made people uncomfortable. So, but Julie, just to address that, I'm with you in that the glory of great memoir really is opening all kinds of doors and revealing all kinds of ways that people lived and all kinds of ways in which people think and process life and process experience. So I think it's a pretty broad world, but I think that's one reason that memoir suddenly got popular. I think the other reason is that there was a period of time when fiction, dominant fiction, and the voices that were getting the most critical attention were really abandoning realistic fiction. And certainly, like, Tom Wolfe addressed that when he started to write nonfiction. And I think memoir slipped into that also.
Oh, I think that's a great point, both about form, but also about the voices. That memoir sort of enabled voices to be heard that just typically hadn't been heard.
I'm thinking about Mary Carr's memoir, Lit. And it was about her alcoholism, but there were broader implications for that memoir as well. I think it opened a lot of doors for people who were feeling shame about their alcoholism, and it sort of laid things on the table for people to feel more comfortable talking about it. And I think about that with memoirs that tackle trauma, and I feel that if there's a broader purpose for that memoir, it makes it even better. It's a richer memoir for that.
I completely agree, Pam, and I think there are examples, you know, of, I'm thinking about Bernard Cooper, his book about A Bill for My Father, which is about his relationship with his father, and there's a passage that's just fabulous about his father's encroaching dementia. So, you know, is that traumatic? Yes, but is it sort of a trauma in the way that a murder or a rape, you know, or just some exceptional and awful event is? No, it's much more chronic than that. And yet he certainly manages to kind of explore an issue that millions of people are experiencing. And that's, you know, emotionally really challenging and heartbreaking. So I think, and occasionally funny and almost exhilarating. And he covers all of that territory. So again, I sort of come back to that a good memoirist can find the general in the very specific and help the reader experience it, even if it's not an extraordinary event.
It's true, because when Pam was mentioning Lit, I haven't read Lit, but just then I sort of started to tick off all the memoirs that I've read and loved about alcoholism. And I've never had problems with alcohol, nor actually has anybody in my immediate family or closest number of friends. But when I think of how different they all are, and I think of how rich, just what came to mind, for instance, is Pete Hamill's A Drinking Life. Julie, have you read that?
I have, long time ago. Yeah.
It's wonderful. It's about growing up in Brooklyn and becoming a newspaper man at a particular period of time. It's also about his story of how drinking and the culture of drinking was just like absolutely through all of that. So that's, to me, is also an example where you could put it in that subgenre of memoirs about alcoholism, and yet it just stands alone as what it's like to grow up as a boy in first-generation Irish family in Brooklyn in the 1940s, you know, just post-war 40s, 50s.
I think there's a great deal of pathos, too, in describing those sort of daily hurdles and obstacles, because when it comes to empathy and relatability, as you say, Julie, you know, those are challenges that all of us experience. And to examine those instances through the eyes of a very accomplished and eloquent and articulate writer, you know, you can re-envision your own life through that lens, which is very powerful.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, well, speaking for myself and certainly in writing this book, but also just my kind of life as a parent, you know, over time, I've grown to appreciate more and more just how much we are all shaped by the times we live in. That so much in our sensibilities that we think are unique to us are actually a product of shared experience. And that's just a thing I'd love to explore. And I think you can explore it in any genre, but memoir lends itself to that as well.
I think there is this notion, too, in regards to the imperative to pick up the pen for a memoirist, perhaps, is this idea that the stories will be lost if they're not told, and that this, you know, writer is a witness to a powerful time. And of course, all of our times are powerful in their own way. So it does seem like this is also a sense of urgency that governs the composition.
I'll tell a tale that is a little bit sort of the downside, since we haven't yet talked about the effect that memoir can have on family members. So, as I've mentioned, I have two daughters. My older daughter was 8 when my first memoir about her younger sister was published, and somebody came over to her at a book signing and said, "So, are you going to read your mother's memoir?" And she said, "I don't need to read it. I lived it." And then she became a filmmaker, and her first film was a documentary, and it was about her sister's transitional year, the year between having entitlements and finishing up school and then going to a point at which there was no funding, no entitlements, and what's next. And it was a verite type of documentary. And so it put me in a position of being the subject, rather than, you know, the person in control of crafting family stories. And it was very interesting for me to suddenly be like the mother in that, you know, in that situation. I really felt like I understood how complicated this genre is when you're writing about people. The other thing that I'll say that relates to this is that I have a very close relationship with her. She did not read Bereft, the second book, because she said, you know, I have my own memories and I don't want to have your memories and your vantage point. I don't want to. I want to be able to process some of this material by myself. So I just offer that up to the conversation.
And you provide a marvelous segue for me, Jane. Thank you. I came across this delightful quote that I really want to share with you both. It's by Tracy Kidder and Richard Todd, who wrote Good Prose, The Art of Nonfiction. And they present in their work 4 basic rules of good behavior for a memorist. And one which really struck me was as follows, quote, "Be harder on yourself than you are on others. The golden rule isn't much use in memoir. Inevitably, you will not portray others just as they would like to be portrayed, but you can at least remember that the game is rigged. Only you are playing voluntarily." unquote. I thought that was quite delightful. And I made me wonder whether you as a memorist feel obliged to present your work in progress to living individuals who are featured within its pages prior to publication and how that dynamic works. And Jane, you've already addressed part of that beautifully. Thank you. What are your thoughts?
This is so interesting because I think I would land on the opposite answer. I did not share any of my book with any of the people in it other than my mother and my husband, who wasn't in it much, before it was published. And in retrospect, I'm sorry I didn't share it with my cousins, because I wrote quite a bit about an aunt of mine, their mother, who was kind of a second mother to me. I regret this because it was an appropriation of sorts. And they were very gracious. They didn't wholly love or agree with everything I'd written, or at least with the balance of what I'd written. But I think had I shown it to them before it was published, they would have given me the same feedback. I probably wouldn't have changed much, but it would have avoided any risk to our relationship. So I think, at some point you do have to, particularly if you're writing material far more sensitive or controversial than anything I wrote, I don't know. I imagine that you do need at a certain point to decide what matters to me more, my relationship or my work, and at least have that conversation. I mean, in contrast, I wrote about colleagues and I wrote a lot about sort of the industry I work in. And because I didn't really care that much about keeping my job at that point, I was much more ready to let the chips fall where they may.
I would never do it again. I did it in the first Rachel book. As I said, I gave it to my then husband, and that was fascinating. He said to me, he carried around the manuscript for a long time. And then when finally he said something, he said, "I hate this book." He said, "It's a terrific book. I hate it reading it as much as I hated living it." But he was very generous in his saying, "Go do whatever you want." But I have to say, I've never gotten over my discomfort, even in pieces in my later years where I'm really not writing about any dramatic family stuff, but it's just the people in my life are characters in my own work. I don't show things to people ahead of time because I think it really is a kind of editing that doesn't allow a writer to really write fully. I'm cognizant of the fact that I'm writing about living people. And I think if the time ever came for me that I didn't care, I should stop writing. So that's basically the best I can say about how I balance it. I do it. I say what's necessary. I have no enemies and I don't think of people as enemies anyhow. But I know I know from having that camera on me at 6 o'clock in the morning. And being a mother in a really uncomfortable situation, I know that it's hard. It turns out in that situation, I totally respected my daughter and what she was doing and thematically where she was going. And so I didn't have any control. I didn't try to control it, but it's hard.
And it is an interesting point that you make there too, Jane, about, whether feedback from that quarter really colors the narrative. If you do then return and edit further, and there is an element too of staying true to your perspective and your story and it being undiluted, perhaps.
I really agree. This is paraphrased with Annie Dillard, who said, writing is an art, it's not a martial art. And I think to go back a little bit, it's like for me to write something, I have to be totally not having any editorial hat on at that particular time. I have to not be thinking about what people are going to think and how they're going to respond. I have to just like be in that hallucinatory moment of seeing it and hearing it. And I think too early on start worrying about what people are going to think, then it's, you don't get the fullness. And I don't think that a definition of fullness means hurting people. Sometimes fullness is just being closer to the complexity of your own response to something. that to me is the danger of showing it. You know, once you're thinking about approval, but it's tough. It's an interesting, vital, wonderful, really tough genre in a lot of ways.
I so admire a memoirist. I think you all are very brave to be able to put down on paper your personal experiences. Sometimes those are difficult experiences. And I wonder, as you're writing, and Jane, I know you say that you can't really put on your editor's hat when you're working. You have to just get into the zone and get it on paper. But do you ever experience a moment where you want to write something, but you're finding it very difficult, maybe because it's something that you're exploring some feelings that you're having? And if that is the case, how do you push through that?
I think there are plenty of instances in which I've decided I don't want to do it. You know, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to render this. I'm not going to, this scene will not be included. So I think when you get to that place in a personal way, without being pushed ahead of time by that question of like, you know, will this person like it? Will this person disapprove? So for sure, since everything is structured and put together and dramatized as true as it might be, you know, you're still basically sewing the stuff together. You're making decisions about what's not worth it. And I think then, you know, Julie, that's a point at which you say, you know what, this isn't worth it. I don't need this person in this piece.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you've said, Jane. Actually, I do agree with everything you've said, certainly about not showing work too soon or letting it become a censor in your head. And I think there's a point at which if you think what you're going to write really runs the risk of jeopardizing, that it's too personal or it's going to jeopardize a relationship that means too much, it's perfectly fine to say, I'm not going to write about this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Leave that out. I mean, I've only once had a really uncomfortable experience, which actually worked out pretty well. But in the second Rachel book, I had written really kind of lovingly about the first in-home behavior management specialist who ever worked with my daughter, and the only man, I should say. And he was a young man, and he got her into Special Olympics. I mean, I loved him. And I had described him as having like a bullet-like head or something like that. I mean, some kind of throwaway description. And he wrote me a lovely note saying how nice it was to see the book and asking about the family and then quoting that line. And I was really sorry that I had been cavalier in that description. He laughed, but still, I then remembered that it can be really hurtful. And was that necessary for me to say he had a bullet, like, you know, I had like a bullet or whatever description I used? It really wasn't necessary. So it was sobering.
Oh, I had a very similar experience. There's one chapter in the book that's recounting a road trip with an old boyfriend who I actually, you know, was very fond of and hadn't been in touch with for 40 years or something. So I used him as in retrospect, I realized, you know, I used him as a prop, almost as comic relief. And he did read the book and he was extremely gracious, but clearly, you know, that bit he saw it and it stung a little. And in retrospect, I thought that it was needless. That if I wanted to be funny, I could have been funny some other way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It does place quite a burden, doesn't it? I mean, this sort of notion of being fair and true to all and sundry, that's quite an undertaking to think about when you are writing about sort of very emotive issues, to then be so cognizant of its reception in different quarters, and not that it would color the narrative, but that these individuals might then read it.
You know, in fiction, I think you have to respect your characters. And I guess I think, well, actually, I was going to say, I think the same is true in memoir, but I don't know if I think that, because if you're writing about somebody really reprehensible, maybe not. So I take that back.
Oh, I don't know. I do. I think you have to in both cases. I think it's really interesting that, again, I go back to the power of writing scenes in nonfiction, because, again, I said this earlier, that when you're writing a scene and you're seeing somebody, it does give you the opportunity to not weigh in and express your disdain for someone, but just sort of let that person be, assuming that you're actually, the scene is evoking a lived event. And so I think in that sense, there can be a kind of hands-off way of dealing with, you know, difficult, problematic people. I do want to say something to sort of spin it around. I mean, I've always been amused that if somebody talks about fiction, the first question I always get is like, is that autobiographical? And when with memoir, they always say, how did you remember that? Did that really happen? So it's really funny. People tend to distrust the memory in memoir and make the assumption in fiction that it must have happened. It's really interesting for me. One of the things that's been fascinating for me in returning to fiction, I described Face to a couple of people as saying that in some places, in some ways, I felt that the novel was thematically truer and closer to me than the memoirs. Now, my memoirs, I tell, you know, obviously it's subjective truth, but I don't blur any lines. I tell the truth as I have experienced it. And the novel is not overtly autobiographical at all. And yet it allowed me in this very backwards, unintentional way of really looking very closely at some thematic stuff, which I think I didn't address kind of as front and center. So it's interesting what fiction can allow you to do with the same material.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I want to switch gears just for a minute and talk a little bit about the writing process. I know you both wrote so much more than ended up in your books, or maybe not. I'm not sure. I might be wrong about that. But if that's the case, how do you whittle down the information and determine what is worthy of including and what is not? Julie?
Your question is coming at an interesting time. I've actually been working on a novel and last night reached the decision that I really did have to throw out about a third of it. So this is a bit of salt on a wound right now. But I think at a certain point, and this is where having other readers is sometimes helpful. I mean, you're certainly right. I think the ratio of what I write to actually use is at least 2-1 and probably more like 3-1. And that's because the first draft is just a process of finding out what I want to say. It's how I find out what I think. And the real intentionality and crafting and shaping happens in the revision. And the stuff that I throw out tends to be the stuff that I realize is actually only interesting to me. And if it's not going to be, because, you know, I've got some very kind of specific, quirky, not widely held interests. And perhaps were I a better writer, I could, I mean, I sometimes succeed in helping other people become as fascinated as I am in some phenomena. But at a certain point, you know, there are times I just have to realize, you know what? This is interesting to me. It's probably not going to be interesting to anyone else. And it goes.
Wow. I'm like Julie. I write to figure out, to hear and to see what it is that interests me. I would like to be a more efficient writer. That is just not going to happen. This is the only way I can do it. I don't write in order. I just write dribs and brabs. I put them together. And so I throw away a lot because it takes me a really long time to find the true heart of the story. With almost everything that I've written, the process of finding the true heart of the story meant throwing away many, 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 many drafts. And I actually think it's true for a lot of writers. I mean, you know, Julie, we all imagine that there's some great writer who starts at the beginning and goes all the way through to the end and then just knocks it out. And unless that's, you know, that's Joyce Carol Oates, but that's not very many other people. There aren't that many people who do it. I always ask, like when I teach, I ask even undergraduates, how many people start at the beginning? I was really curious. How do you do it? Do you start at the beginning and work all the way through to the end? And some people do, but many of them, you know, kind of raise their hands tentatively as if they're finding out for the first time ever that they're not the only ones who like start in some middle place and just kind of see what's there.
Yeah, I think the nicest gift, I had an MFA faculty member, Pinckney Benedict, and the nicest gift he ever gave me, although I didn't think of it as a gift at the time, he said, you know, you don't have to write this in order. And it was a criticism of what I'd turned in, but learning that lesson early has helped me as a fiction writer, because to sit down and write from A to Z makes for a very difficult task and not a very pleasurable one, in my opinion, because you can't let scenes come to you and write them down. You're thinking to yourself, no, that has to come later. But really, you have to write what comes to you and then put it together later in a structure that makes sense.
Right. That's how it happens. And for essays, for me, very often, which I have to say, in a certain way, I think are the most natural form for me, because I'm by nature kind of a hand wringer, muller, kind of gnawer on a bone kind of person. But so often I think I know what it is I want to be writing about, and inevitably that initial impetus to write is not what ends up being the main piece of it, the main thematic piece.
I feel exactly the same way. Maybe that's a quality of people for whom essay is the most natural or attractive form. Because I feel the same. What the book ends up being about is never what it started out being about. And the beauty of the essay that sort of makes its way, I find, into my fiction as well, is just this notion of you're holding something in your hand and you can rotate it and you can lift it up and you can just look at it in all of its aspects. Actually, it's interesting. I'm taking a drawing course, and yesterday my drawing teacher said something about, you know, she was sort of trying to console those of us who can't do any sort of literal representation of reality. Like, I'm a terrible drawer. But she said something like, well, as soon as you know what you want, you stop seeing, you stop looking. And I just thought, oh, yeah, that describes my writing life. I thought that was pretty great. Yeah.
I'd like to broach a subject of truth in memoirs, if we might, for a moment. And, you know, we've touched upon the distinctions between memoirs and autobiographies. And Gore Vidal makes an interesting distinction between these definitions in his memoir, Palimpsest, published in 1995. He says a memoir is how one remembers one's life, while an autobiography is history requiring research, dates, facts double-checked. In a memoir, he says, it isn't the end of the world if your memory tricks you and your dates are off by a week or a month, as long as you honestly try to tell the truth. There's also the imperative for a memoirist to write a narrative work that is engaging and compelling, one that other individuals will want to read. And Ben Yagoda, who writes of the history and origin and types of different memoirs, he stipulates that, quote, once you begin to write the true story of your life in a form that anyone would possibly want to read, you start to make compromises with the truth. So I'm wondering what role you think truth plays in the formulation of memoirs, and how can you thread that needle between an entertaining narrative and truth-telling in memoirs?
I think, and I know I've been on all these panel discussions, I know that memoirists have all kinds of viewpoints on this. My own viewpoint is I have made a pact with the reader that I'm going to tell the truth as best as I recall it, that at the heart of memoir is subjective truth. So I'm not saying things are objectively true. Somebody else might have a different memory of something, but I'm going to honor it. And I feel that part of that is that's what makes it memoir. But I also feel like all that Julie and I have talked about about circling around things and trying to figure them out, trying to sort of figure out what you feel about things, et cetera, comes from this close examination of what happens. And once you start fudging with what happens, you can't get there. And so I think actually, even though there are a lot of memoirs who say, oh, you know, there's not that much of a line, it really blurs, I don't think it serves memoir the best. And I guess I want to say one other sort of introductory thing is, and Julie hit on this a little bit. Some of my favorite pieces of memoir, like Woman Warrior, Maxine Kong, Han Kingston, where the memoirist is really on the page saying, I imagine, what if? So they're actually really on the page as saying, I don't remember this, I'm coming up with what I would like to have happened or what I imagine happened. And I think that that technique of being able to be on the page with what isn't fully remembered is a really powerful strategy also in constructing memoir. So I'm really rigid on that topic.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think if we're calling it nonfiction, we have to do our very best to be as truthful as we can. I think because memoir tends to employ a lot of the same techniques as fiction. So, I mean, there's scene, there's dialogue. So I'll often be asked, how do you remember that conversation? Well, I don't verbatim. I mean, I remember the sense I made of that conversation. I may remember some specific comment that someone made, but you know, I think when you're reconstructing or creating dialogue, you know, there it's a given that it's not a literal transcript, but I still feel obliged to be as truthful as I can. And Jane, I think you made a great point that when you deviate from that, you actually don't serve the work. I remember one of the first nonfiction things I ever wrote was my mother's cousin had died, and I was physically the closest person to New York where she lived. And so I was tasked with going to her apartment and, you know, her safe deposit box. Anyway, I found this letter. She had a beautiful older sister, and I had always been under the impression that her father, who was kind of a thug, had actually had an incestuous relationship with her older sister. And I wanted to write about this whole experience of cleaning out the apartment and to put that fact in there. But I checked it with my mother, who said, no, there was no incest, but certainly the older sister was the favored child. So at the time, I was sort of kicking myself for asking, because now that I knew the facts, the truth, you know, I couldn't write the story I had wanted to write. But the story I did write, I ended up feeling was a much richer story, that living with an older sister who was so obviously favored without it being technically deviant or perverse or whatever you want to call it was actually an even sadder story in some respects.
It's also an interesting backdrop because in recent years, there have been a number of memoirs published by major publishers, some that were well received critically and became bestsellers, even though they were subsequently proven to be partially or completely fabricated. And even the purported author of the work was a fabrication. And a number of these recent fake memoirs fall into the category of misery lit, where authors claim to have overcome bereavement, abuse, addiction, poverty, and other overwhelming losses. And it just seems awful to me, honestly, as if you're profiteering from this kind of sensationalism, which you both referred to earlier. And I also wonder, I mean, as a result of these recent series of best-selling memoirs having been outed for falsification, there have been calls for stronger vetting and fact-checking of an author's material. But where and with whom do you think the responsibility for this kind of fact-checking lies? I mean, it would, you know, speaking as a publisher, to do this kind of investigative work would be impossible for us. So I'd love your thoughts on that.
Wow. I think for small press, you're right. It's really hard, but the major presses have legal teams. And like for the James Fry, I mean, the sense that I had, I mean, Nan Talese was his editor, and she's a really big deal. And the sense I had was that he was encouraged. It was originally a work of fiction, and he had been encouraged to write it as a memoir instead. I mean, that was just awful. But I do think, like, for instance, isn't it possible for you to say, can you verify these facts to a writer who brings in something that's like a really shocking memoir of something supposedly that's happened?
Oh, certainly. And I suppose it depends really on the depth of that kind of fact-checking that is required. And because of that, you know, additional intensive work, it may well lead small presses to say, you know, we can't take this one on because we can't verify it. But I think also, you know, these kinds of themes can also be powerful in fiction. And what a shame, you know, if you're writing something which is partially fictionalized, but it has some root in memoir and in actual experience, it can still produce a powerful work of fiction that carries a strong message, perhaps without being so explicitly categorized as a memoir and all of that commitment to truth which is then entailed.
For sure. I mean, that's why I think people are always making the assumption with all works of fiction that it must have been lived, because if it's a really powerful work of fiction, it reads like lived experience. So I agree with you. Call it fiction. It's really does a disservice to memoirs and memoirists to have these made up stories and then call them nonfiction.
Jane and Julie, I'm going to be on vacation in about a week. I'd like to take two memoirs with me. Can you each recommend one? Maybe your favorite or one you've recently read that you enjoyed?
I love Edwige Danticat's Brother, I'm Dying. That is a memoir I've read, I don't know, four times because I've taught it, five times I've taught it. So Brother, I'm Dying, I really, really, really love. I love Skateboards Are Free, Saeed, I can't pronounce his last name. It's a very, very long Iranian name. And it's a memoir about a kid who grows up with a staunch communist mother in Pittsburgh. It turns out I knew the mother, but it's a really, really wonderful memoir, a really, really interesting book. So those are two I would recommend.
Wonderful. Great. What about you, Julie?
Well, it's Vivian Gornick's Fierce Attachments. I is still kind of my memoir Bible. There's a graphic memoir by Roz Chast. Can we please talk about something more pleasant? And that's just an amazing book. Yeah. So those top of mind, those would be my top two.
That's great. I've read the Roz Chast one and I love that one. And I love Edwige Danticat's fiction. I haven't read her memoir. So I will be looking forward to that. Yeah. So thank you. This will be great. I'll have many things to keep me busy. Thank you both. It's so much fun to talk with you both about writing memoir and hearing your thoughts on it and hearing your recommendations. That was wonderful. And John Cheever's daughter, Susan Cheever, you may be familiar with her work. She said that I believe that the memoir is the novel of the 21st century. It's an amazing form that we haven't even begun to tap. We're just getting started figuring out what the rules are. So thank you for helping us figure out what the rules are. This has been fantastic. Thank you for your time.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. It's been a delightful discussion. And for all those listening in, this All at Onceness and The Face Tells the Secret can be purchased on our website at www.regalhousepublishing.com. Indeed, the very best way to support an indie press is to buy books directly from their website, and we at Regal House are most grateful for your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. We'd love to hear from you. And we hope that you'll join us for our next episode on A Conspiracy of Lemurs, Remembering Mama, Growing Up in South Los Angeles with Dr. Mary Hill Wagner. From all of us at Regal, keep reading.